Mark is at another dig. It turns out the year 2126 is the year of archidateology. You know, data before it knew it was data. So we've had to divide the labor, but this is too exciting to wait. Our crack rock bottom team has been called to examine some bones at a construction site near Pittsburgh, PA. Why call archidateologists? Well, these bones are under an old office building that contains several large consulting firms. And evidence points to the bones being connected with what went on in this building. Why are these bones here? What stories can they tell? Let's see here. Let's see. Wow. Well, first thing, see the threads near the neck? Back then, professionals adorned themselves with colorful neckwear. We have no idea why. If we assume then this was a professional consultant, what was their job? Well, let's take a closer look. It's a young person. Note the straight bones, signs of youth, not real experienced. But here's a puzzle. The cranium shows some distortion across the back. The forehead has deep furrowed brows. The skin muscles themselves deformed his forehead. Boy, all signs of extreme mental stress. Oh, jackpot. Next to the body, here's a book. A book. A few letters are visible on the cover. Oh, it's very, very big decay here. Wait a second, wait. Something, something, Y, T, Mer. My timer? Daytime, day, I don't know. Anyway, it's a diary of some sort. The pages are in bad shape, but a few notes are obvious here. Let's see. Lots of meetings. This is, yeah, definitely a meeting book. Same topic, business case for data strategy, justification for data governance issues. Some notes in the margin here. This client is a jerk. Oh, well, okay. Another note, why can't they see the obvious? Data is important to AI success. Wow, AI, this might help us where Mark is. He's at the dig that's explaining the great AI upheaval of 2041. Well, okay, wait. Well, here's a note in the book, but it's not part of the book. It's full. Oh, I got to be very careful here. I have to be very careful. It's different handwriting. Don't worry about it. They're still buying a lot of our services. The more trouble they get into, the more they need us. Signed, your boss. Wow. Wow, there's a story to tell, but we need to keep digging. Wow. Oh, look at this. Look at this.
John. John? John. Where is he? I'm pretty sure he said 2126. How am I going to start the show without him? No, not yet.
Sorry, just trying to help.
I appreciate it. Let's see. I think I have a recording. Should at least be good enough to get us started.
This is John Ladley.
And Mark Cooper.
And the Talking Moose.
Welcome to the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Still haven't seen John, have you?
I have not seen him either.
Any ideas?
Yes.
Care to share?
Start the monologue music. He will show up for sure.
That's brilliant.
Of course it is.
After that, we have the second half of our conversation with John Padfield, Dispatches, the famous game show, and the 8-Bit Consultants.
Sounds like a great show. I hope he doesn't miss it.
He won't. Watch this.
Are you going to start the music or what?
Hang on, I'm queuing it up.
Hurry up already.
Be patient. All right, got it. Here it comes. Sure hope this works. Here he is.
I just returned from the Big Data Quality Enterprise Data World Conference in San Diego. It was a great event, but a little bit different. I'd like to share my impressions. Of course, AI dominated the conversation, and there were debates. Especially debates between AI is just another tool or something really big and scary. In my interactions with attendees and speakers, when I mentioned anthropology and anthropological aspects, they all said, wow, I never thought of it that way. Well, that means AI goes way beyond our data conference, and people need to realize that. Data people, however, are still the most prepared for whatever's coming, and we know there will be unintended consequences, and we have to defend against them. Also, too many people mentioned to me that their AI areas were prohibiting conversations or not talking to people in data governance or data management who can generally help, and that's a problem. So some solutions. What are your rules for AI? The current U.S. administration has made sure it's going to stay the Wild West. You got to make your own rules up. What are your data quality standards? Who's the throat to choke when it goes bad? Who's using AI for a productivity thing and are producing work, but no one's reviewing that work? Executives who are listening, forget whatever beef you have with some failed data warehouse project in the past. You need to get some oversight now on AI, and it's more than just the oversight from that team. Some wise person said, be careful what you ask for. You might get it. Well, data people, executives, managers, you are being handed a solid business case for AI and data people, and you have an open door to help each other. It's up to us to watch out for disasters. Are you going to step up and be nice to each other?
We now continue our conversation with John Padfield.
Right. So that kind of leads us to what are the positive steps? Data itself, I think, is agnostic. It's neutral. And so, as you mentioned before, you can use it for positive purposes. You can use it for negative purposes. Staying on this guardrails topic, we've talked about awareness, talked about transparency, talked about the Fourth Amendment. And then from an individual's perspective or from a corporate perspective, how does a company even begin to have the conversation, let alone the policies and the audits, getting out, 100 yards ahead of our headlights around, what do you tell a marketing analyst and say, these are the purposes that this data was collected for. And do you have to ask everybody, is there expectation that you have to ask anybody that you got the data from if you can use it for this other purpose? It's sort of like the question of video on the streets. Right, you can't get a video release from everybody you happen to capture in your cell phone as you're taking video of somebody on the streets. And how does that work with data in a corporate setting and then also in a personal setting?
That is a great question, and I wish I had a concise answer to that. Here's one of my concerns that addresses that. If I go out and take a picture of something, and you raise a good point, do we have an expectation of privacy on the street? The answer is nuanced. If you are walking on the sidewalk past my house, it's entirely legal for me to have a security camera that picks you up. I could stand on my front porch and take a picture of you walking on the sidewalk in front of me because you don't have an expectation of privacy of no one's going to see me. But that's a little bit different than I'm going to run an app on this phone that shares everything that camera sees to a national database that does facial recognition. So if someone wants to know where you are, they could upload your photo and then search a million different video streams until they find out that you were in front of my house at this time on this day. That's a little bit different. It's kind of like a Second Amendment argument. Second Amendment, you have a right to keep and bear arms. Does that include nuclear missiles? Well, no, most people would not call nuclear missiles arms. But it's that same idea. Do I have the ability to take your picture? Yes, in public, I have the ability to take your picture. But do I have the ability to set up, not just me, could somebody organize millions of live streams that go into an AI database that is doing a facial recognition search? Because quite literally, that is what Flock Safety is putting together right now. They just did a partnership with Ring, Amazon Ring, to get access to doorbell cameras. There are millions of them around the country. And I have read the patent that Flock Safety has for their, quote, this is their term, not mine, dynamic surveillance network. And their patent describes taking live video feeds and doing image recognition, not just faces, but if you come to my door and I have a Ring doorbell, that Ring doorbell can say a man approximately this tall of this build wearing these clothes. And then when you walk away from my house, my neighbor's camera picks you up and there is a person that matches that description. That's what Flock's patent is all about, a dynamic surveillance network that uses AI and countless video streams to track everyone. And that's where we really do have to pump the brakes on this and say, wait a minute, there are ramifications of monitoring everyone, everywhere, all the time. And we have not had a public debate about this. When you go back and look at the Constitutional Convention, it lasted for months. There were representatives from 12 states who got together to hammer this out. And what they agreed to had to be sent back to the states for ratification. And what we have today is a couple of smart engineers working for a big tech company saying, hey, I just figured out a way to take this satellite feed, this dash cam, this doorbell, put it all together. Let's implement it.
You know, it's the allure of the algorithm and the sexiness of technology is something we've talked about when we had one of our peers, a fellow named David Lotion, on here, and he calls it the bias, the technology bias. It's new, it's shiny, it's sexy, and we forget our essential components of civilized life because of that. I called up the Fourth Amendment here, and as a amateur constitutional historian type person, it sounds like all three of us actually read this stuff. Mm-hmm. when we see it, we actually read the case material and things like that. I mean, there's strong wording here to apply that to what we're dealing when you talk about persons, houses, papers, and effects. There is a strong connect here. So there is obviously a lot we need to do societal and things like that. There's a couple of personal things I wanted to ask you about, because I haven't heard you speak directly on this on your pod. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, is called Business Reform, correct?
Yes, Business Reform. Yes.
That was a plug, by the way, so you're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay,
it's all right. Right,
anyway, so our dozens of listeners will just leap right over there, okay? You might see a little blip on your statistics. Anyway, the word ignorant is considered pejorative, right? Mm-hmm. But in the dictionary, ignorant has two meanings. There's one, the pejorative, which means you're ignorant, right? And then there's the lacking knowledge of a subject. Mm-hmm. All right. The Fortune 500, the Fortune 1000, the Russell 3000, whatever, is ignorant at the leadership level about all these. Yeah, data is for a purpose. I do my financial statements. Now that same data is another purpose and it's going to get you sued. No one instinctively knows that. And that's why our podcast started. We want to fix that. However we can, or at least start to fix that in some way, shape or form. So that's why we're kind of diving into some of the more individual type things, because a lot of our folks are practitioners and they don't even know what words to use. One of our big obstacles out there, you know, you teach analytics. Well, the person out there writing the Python code, the person out there doing that stuff, they have never heard these discussions. Mm-hmm. They're just doing their job.
Yes.
They're just, and they don't have a boss says, do this report with this data on it. I mean, I had a client, I still have a client or two, cause I can't peel myself away from the business. You know, they sent me a test file and it was social security numbers, names and addresses from a bank. and all their loans and all their obligations and all that. And they said, "What's the test file?" I said, "That's okay. You have a non-disclosure agreement." What? That? Yeah, no, no. I mean, you should be educated at the undergraduate level that you don't do that. You should know that. It's no different than walking around with your pants off. You just don't do that. Okay.
Yeah.
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 Your point about them sending you that test file. I have a very similar situation right now. I'm going to be speaking at a conference in Mexico City next month, which means I'm going to be traveling by plane outside of the country, which means I'm going to be going through customs. I have a laptop with very sensitive information on it. I never anticipated this when I started my YouTube channel, but I have a Proton email account and I always give out my email address in my videos. I have had whistleblowers contact me through my Proton account and I have downloaded that to my laptop. And I always have to be extremely careful because usually this is done anonymously. The person's not giving me their name, but they are sharing information with me. And the first thing I have to evaluate is this real? Because I have I have stepped on toes. I know that. Mm-hmm. And it always goes through my mind, is somebody trying to set me up, mm-hmm. giving me information, hoping I will run with it and say something demonstrably false to discredit me or possibly even something defamatory that could get me mm-hmm. sued. And so, you know, that's my first filter. Is this real? And then the second thing is, what, if anything, should I do with it? Because sometimes I get information that's interesting, but it's going to become a distraction. It's not really what my focus is, and I'm not the right person to do anything with it. Every now and then I get information, and I have responded to people, not even knowing their real name, but I have responded to people with the name of an attorney that I know saying, "This is a legal issue. I am not qualified to give legal advice other than I'll give you this advice. Talk to this guy. He's licensed." But I get this type of information. My point where I'm going with all of this, I do not want to take my laptop through customs because today, if for any reason I'm targeted, somebody can plug in a device to my computer, copy its contents, and there are sensitive things, nothing that I've done wrong, but information. I've had several emails that I've received that have prompted me to make videos because somebody tipped me off to something going on and I dug into it and found my own corroborating evidence and made videos based on some tips that I've gotten.
Well, here's some.
I just don't want that falling into the wrong hands. So I can't take my laptop through customs. I'm getting a separate Linux laptop.
Thank you
for my presentation.
You just took the words out of my mouth. You shove your PowerPoint onto something else and and take it with you. I'm looking at a stack of 3 Macs in addition to the one I'm using here. All right. And they're all loaded, duplicated, and ready to go because of exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Absolutely spot on. There's a couple of things that have come up when Mark and I talking, and we're exploring this. There was been some talk about this a few years ago. We don't know if it's still alive or not. First of all, should we point people into thinking that their data has monetary value, and we should strive in some way to say, well, if you're going to gather this stuff for me, and if you're going to track whatever's on my little goggle box here, you're going to pay for that. You know, you want to listen to John Ladley's personal life and see where he rides his bicycle and stuff like that. It's going to cost you $200 a month. All right. And start to drain some of those billions of dollars out of the system. That's one thing we've kicked around. So I'd like your thoughts on that. Do you think we should at some point in time in the future, we already think we should tweak the Constitution. Okay. Should we think of a way for people to get paid for the data, put a price on it, and maybe make that as an adjudicator of transparency and data activity?
I don't have a problem with that, provided it's done under the following conditions.
Okay.
Number one, it is purely opt-in, not a you're in by default. I want it to be
like Europe, it's an opt-in, yes. Not an opt-out. Okay.
And number two, if I do not opt in, I want protection saying you're not going to pull me in anyway and just not give me any money. If I don't opt in to sharing in the profit, you have to leave me alone. If yeah. that were the case, I would love it. I would embrace that in a heartbeat because to me, I don't want the money. I want the privacy. But if somebody else says, hey, forget about mm-hmm. the privacy. It's not that valuable to me. I want the money. Perfect. Go in peace. We're in agreement on this. But I want it to be an either or. Take the money or leave me alone. None of this. Well, we're going to buy and sell your data without your consent.
Okay. And I'll ask one.
But you would need to take that one step further, I think, because the fact that you opted out of it is an important piece of information as well. It's not unlike the robocalls that just call number to number to number and record which ones somebody picks up. You know, the fact that you answered the phone, they don't need to talk to you. They don't want, you know, they just want to know it's a live number with a person at the other end. And the fact that you opted out of that is an important data point as well.
Well, and here's what I expect would happen. Depending on the dollar amount that's being offered, is it 10 bucks a month or is it 100 bucks a month?
Yeah.
Depending on the amount of money being offered, I expect you would see 70 to 85% opt in to say, I'll take the money.
Yeah.
That's great. If that's what you want, I have no problem with that. But those holdouts like me, we're probably going to become targets because, well, why doesn't this person want the money? And that's probably going to spark curiosity and probably underhanded attempts to get our data even more because we didn't.
There's a PhD there. There's a paper there because I think it would stratify. I think Gen Z, Gen A, millennials would monetize their personal data. Because I mean, I've had people work for me. We had a guy on our team a few years ago that said, "Well, when I start putting chips in next, I'm the first one in line." You know, because I want an enhanced user experience. Okay. Then there's our generation, which is like, get out of my face. There's some research that has to be done there. I don't know. I can see different answers to that. I can see this thing stratifying generationally, demographically, psychographically. Mm-hmm. We could talk about this for a really long time. Mark, you've got...
Right, because people would people behave any differently than they do today? Because, you know, why do you think your Kroger card... Yeah. What do you think they're doing with your Kroger card? No, it's not, you know, yeah, coupons. Okay. That's swell. You get 20 cents off your loaf of bread, but you know, there's a lot more they're doing with the coupons than just.
John's going to fix it. Here we go. Yay.
I didn't say I had a solution. I said I have an answer to the question.
Oh, darn.
But do people behave differently when they know they're being watched? Yes, they do. Now, can they get accustomed to it? I'll share this with
you. It's kept me out of jail my whole life.
I used to do a lot of consulting work, and there was a small manufacturing company, about a dozen employees, that were having some productivity issues. And when I was hired to help them, I went in, looked around, and I told the owner of the company, with your permission and with the full knowledge of everyone on the floor, I would like to put a GoPro camera up in that corner of the shop floor, broad, wide-angle lens. And I said, I'm not trying to catch anyone doing anything bad. What I want to do is just get a feel for the heartbeat. When does this machine shut off? And when does the material move to this machine? I just want to see the heartbeat of the production floor.
See, an engineer in data is dangerous. This is yes. good. Keep going.
The owner loved the idea. He told his people, we're putting this up there. It's going to be there for a week. And I told him, I'm not even going to look at the data for the first 2 days because... the first 2 days that a camera's up there, people are not going to behave the same. I'm going to wait till day three. And on day three, I got really good data about, you know, how long does this take? And then how long does something sit before it moves to this machine? And I got some really great insights because I can watch an 8-hour shift in 5 minutes and got some great insights off of it. So people will behave differently for a while, but here's the big thing. People start altering their behavior based on what they think is acceptable. And, you know, think about social media. And I catch myself on YouTube doing this. YouTube drives me nuts because I make serious content. I don't make clickbait. But when I am reading a story that involves somebody arrested for terrorism, but I can't say the word terrorism. I can talk about the T word, or I can talk about people that bring down buildings, but I cannot use the word terrorist, or else the YouTube algorithm is going to ding me and my video is not going to get as many views. The same thing, somebody was killed. Can't say killed. You can say they were unalived. You can say that they assumed room temperature, but you can't use this word because this word is on the naughty list on YouTube. And again, it's not clickbait. It's just, I have to censor myself or else the algorithm's going to punish me. And that is what I see as one of the big societal cost when AI is monitoring everything. Larry Ellison, who was briefly the richest man in the world last September when Oracle stock spiked, Larry Ellison said in an investor call in September of 2024, this is a direct quote, "We will have supervision. People will be on their best behavior because we will be recording everything." And then he went on to say how AI is going to be analyzing body cam from police, dash cams, doorbell cams. And because AI is monitoring and all of these video feeds, that people are going to be on their best behavior. And to me, that sounds like a James Bond villain talking. I'm going to implement this control system across the entire country because I'm wealthy and I can.
China. have a social behavior index, which is put together by mining observational data from every camera and every ticket turnstile and everything else in the country.
Let's turn it the other direction. Can AI be used to push back? How do we as the little people use AI to our benefit?
I'm working on a video right now about the most private AI assistants, because I'll admit I use six different ones. Whoa. And I use six of them because I don't trust any of them. But if I use ChatGPT, Grok, Claude, Perplexity, a couple of others. But if I have something I'm really interested in, I go out to multiple ones and ask the same question and compare answers. And then the other thing is I always go to the citations that they find. And I'll share this with you because I found this fascinating. There was an event that I heard a YouTuber mention, but they did not cite their source. And that drives me nuts. I always cite my sources in my YouTube videos. But a YouTuber made a comment about something that supposedly happened at Charlie Kirk's memorial service. And I was very interested in it. If this is true, I want to know. So I went to ChatGPT and said, this claim was made about this incident that happened at Charlie Kirk's memorial service. Can you find any online evidence? ChatGPT comes back, 30 seconds later, there is no credible evidence about that. Okay. Then I went to Perplexity. Perplexity is probably my favorite of the ones that I just mentioned. But I asked Perplexity the same question, any evidence of this? And it came back and the language is almost identical to ChatGPT. There are no credible sources that describe this happening. And then I went to Grok and Grok took about a second and a half to say, yes, that was discussed in depth on Fox News. And it gave me a citation to it. And I thought, okay, ChatGPT and Perplexity, do you not consider Fox News a reputable source? And I don't want to get into the politics behind it, but they are a mainstream source, whether you agree with them or not. So when you say that there is no credible source, are you saying that Fox is not credible? Or are you saying that you just didn't dig hard enough, you didn't look at Fox? But Grok found what I was looking for when the other two told me it didn't exist. And regardless what anyone thinks of Fox, they are still mainstream, and I would have expected the other AIs to have found it.
Yep, same thing. I've done several articles on "You Are What You Eat" when you're a large language model.
I'm going to have to look those articles up. That's a fascinating title. You got me hooked.
Looking now a little bit broader than that, how do we as a society push back using AI?
This is new enough, and I know that AI itself is not brand new. Its origins go back decades, but it's probably been the last 3 to 4 years that AI has gone mainstream with ChatGPT. As a professor, it's something I have to be very cautious with my students, because there are some students I'm quite certain are using AI for some of their assignments. And we've had
big
discussions in faculty meetings about to just say you can't use AI is a non-starter. And we realize that. And so the real question for us as professors, how do we ensure a student is learning? And, you know, some of it's going to be, we're going to give you exams in class that must be completed in class without any electronic devices. And, that's going to give us some insights on your writing ability, your reasoning ability. Mm-hmm. But anyway, don't mean to go down that rabbit hole. My point is,
we can go down that rabbit.
But, the publicly accessible AI is new enough. We are still wrestling with what are its limitations, and its limitations are a moving target. It's getting better by the day. That's another one of those areas I can point to say this technology is growing exponentially. And there is a phenomenon. I lived through this 20 years ago with Sarbanes-Oxley. Companies started doing all types of things that made no sense. And when you ask, why are we doing this? Oh, we have to, Sarbanes-Oxley. No. Sarbanes-Oxley has nothing to do with this policy. Sarbanes-Oxley became the boogeyman to excuse a whole bunch of things that the company wanted to do that maybe they just didn't have the guts to say we're doing it until they had something to blame it on.
And it didn't change anything.
Yes.
It didn't. I went through it. I've been at this about 40 years. And initially we thought Sarbanes-Oxley or Sarbox, if you were hip, was going to be the full employment act for good data governance people and good data management people. We wouldn't have to justify our existence anymore because there it was, regulation. And all what we found out was the CEO, because of this ignorance gap we talked about, would just go to the CFO, are these numbers right? Because I could go to jail. And the CFO says, the numbers are right. Okay, I'll sign it. End of discussion.
Yeah. Same thing with the ISO 9001. You know, all you had to do was put a sticker that says obsolete for reference only on every book on your cubicle, and everything was good.
You'll get a kick out of this. A company that I used to work for as a direct employee, I won't name them.
It's okay.
But quarterly, when the investor call came out, to avoid insider trading or anything, the quarterly report was not shared internally until it was shared externally. So it was out simultaneously. But this was right after Microsoft had done an update to Word. And there was a feature where it tracked changes. Mm-hmm. There was a document explaining the last quarter's performance, and this document had been jointly edited by the CEO and the CFO of a Fortune 500 company.
Oops. Oh, I can see it coming now.
They did not erase all of the tracked changes. Uh-huh. And so when I got my copy of it, the same time it went out to the investor community, when I got my copy of it, I opened it in Microsoft Word, and boom, there are all of the changes. And there were a couple of them that I laughed out loud. The CFO had made a comment about underperforming sales in Europe and the catastrophic blah, blah, blah. And the CEO had marked it out and said, don't use the word catastrophic. You'll scare the investors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this is in the document that went to the investors.
Well, yeah. Well, this is that
you
whole.
You can't make this stuff up.
This is the whole education thing. We as a society, as people, don't know how to ethically behave. We don't know what the rules are. Most of us get up in the morning and we want to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. But what the hell is the right thing in the 21st century? We really don't know. I mean, you know, we can take it from there. I think, Mark,
I was going to follow up real quickly on, well, that I teach introductory computer science to primarily non-majors at Rhodes College here in Memphis, and have the same challenges that you do with students using ChatGPT and writing their programs, and anything that can be assigned as homework can come back AI generated, and will. And I think it's an unrealistic expectation to think to just simply say, no, you can't use it, and you know, it's verboten and like that. But what I found is exactly what you described. is that my exams are all on paper. You know, they're paper. There's a programming component, but it's on the computers that are in the classroom there. So you can't use other stuff there and watch them when they're doing it. And the stratification there is stark and obvious, and you know exactly who's been doing the homeworks and the programs all along, and you know exactly who's not been doing the homeworks.
Beads of sweat. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And the grades. No, it's
the crying.
Totally obvious that the A and B, everybody gets A's and B's on the homeworks. It's, everybody gets the homeworks, and then you get half the class gets A's and B's on the test, and the rest of the class gets D's and F's on the test. And it's very, very obvious. And I tell them, right, the first day of class, I said, look, this is what's going to happen. This is what I've seen. This is, it's like playing a musical instrument. You got to practice. And if you try to take the shortcut, you're not going to perform well. So yeah, seeing exactly those same things that you're seeing in my classes.
Okay, John, we ask every guest the same two questions. Okay. So the first question is, name a person, alive or dead, that has influenced you the most in your career and related to data, if that could help a little bit.
Wow. A couple of people come to mind. I have had the pleasure of working for a couple of outstanding bosses over the course of my career. Matt Tate, when I worked at General Motors, and Steve Cox, when I worked at Hill-Rom. They have been significant influences on my career. My dad, he was a blue collar worker, but he had an incredibly strong work ethic. And that's something that I picked up from him. So those would be the three people that have probably influenced me the most from a career standpoint, although none of them were really data people.
Perfect. That's great. Now here's our second question. And this one we have a lot of fun with. Okay. You have all of a sudden either hired Harry Potter or you yourself have now magical powers. And you can change one thing in this anthropologically distorted, chaotic world of data. You can fix one thing with a thought and a snap of your fingers. What would you fix?
I'm going to need just a minute on this. It's kind of okay. Like having that genie with a wish.
It's exactly what it is. You have a genie, you have one wish, and you can't wish for more wishes.
With very limited time to think about it, where my mind goes is I would wish that people would have the foresight to better anticipate unintended consequences, because so many people, myself included, do things because we just didn't think through what could go wrong. And so often people get into a situation that is a million times easier to get into than get out of. That could take the form of anything from buying into a timeshare to agreeing to a privacy policy to anything else. But I would wish that everyone would have the ability to better foresee unintended consequences.
John Padfield, a famous podcast guy, the Business Reform Channel on YouTube. Thank you so much for being on the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
It's been my pleasure to be here with you. I've enjoyed our conversation and would welcome a chance to come back in the future if you want me.
In his monologue, John shared some of his observations from the recent DGIQ EDW conference. It was a great week. A lot of participants and a lot of enthusiasm. I hope you can join us this fall for the DGIQ AI Gov conference. I hope I'm there. But in the meantime, go to dataversity.net to find training, webinars, articles, and if you use discount code ROCK15, you can get 15% off your first purchase. That's ROCK15 at dataversity.net. These are dispatches from Rock Bottom, dredging up practical information, advice, and food for thought. John Padfield talked about how data collected for one purpose can later be used for something very different. The example he gave of the Franklin Roosevelt administration using census data to determine who to place into internment camps was devastating, certainly to those individuals and families, but also to trust in the government. Nobody filling out their census forms could have imagined that the data would be used that way. Now, not all examples are that consequential. Some are just creepy. Most of us have experienced this one. It was early December, and my wife and I were sitting together talking about what to get our son for Christmas. A Harry Potter Lego set seemed like a good option, and you already know what's coming. Later that evening, we both started seeing pop-up ads for Harry Potter Lego sets on websites and in our news feeds. But let me take just a minute and swap one tinfoil hat for another. It seems unlikely that tech companies are actually listening to our conversations all the time. Meta, Amazon, Google, and others consistently deny using smartphone microphones to listen to our conversations for the purpose of ad targeting. But then again, we know about denials. But then again, the amount of processing bandwidth and battery power required is non-trivial, and researchers have found no difference in smartphone resource consumption in noisy rooms and in silent rooms. Some companies and platforms tout active listening, and most third-party apps are silent about how microphone data is used, so it's still possible. But what may be even more alarming is that all this speech analysis really isn't necessary. Marketers have gotten so good at targeting consumers using just the digital footy prints that we leave all over the place that more often than not, it just seems like they're listening. Why go to the bother of surveillance when we freely give it up ourselves? Here's one more that was in the news recently. Did you play Pokemon Go? Odds are you did. The app was downloaded over 1 billion times, and at its peak, it had more than 200 million monthly active players. For those who didn't play it, Pokemon Go was a mobile augmented reality game where players walked around holding up their phone camera looking for and catching virtual Pokemon that appeared based on their location. It was marketed as a new way to play Pokemon, which was already popular, while at the same time getting outside. It was also an enormous data collection effort. Niantic, which partnered with Nintendo on the game, was spun off from Google and has a long-term goal of building a machine-readable model of the physical world. Do you remember giving permission for that? That's what I think. Do you have other examples? We'd love to hear your stories if you're willing to share. Drop a comment or write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com. And we're back with John Padfield for our famous game show, the Audio Data Rorschach Test. Now, in a minute, I'm going to ask you to pick a number between 1 and 4 to maintain the illusion of randomness. And we'll play for you a piece of royalty-free public domain music. And because
we're broke.
And since music is evocative, we'd like you to tell us the first thing that you think of when you hear it that's related to data. Okay? Make sense?
Makes sense. I'll do my best.
Yes. All right. It's great. So let's pick a number, 1 to 4.
Let's do number one.
Okay. Queuing up number one.
First one up. Here we go.
Wait for it.
I just had to wait till it went all dubstep on us there. I mean, that's really good.
So my first emotion that comes to mind with that related to data, I don't recognize that music, but it reminds me of a circus. And when the lower pitch instruments come in towards the end, it sounded like disruption. And so where my mind goes with data is, you've got a status quo. No matter what that status quo is, something significantly disrupted it when you added in these new instruments. And so that's really what I see in society. We are having a level of connectedness. I'm going to tie this to one book that I read several years ago. Dr. Neil Post wrote the book Entertaining Ourselves to Death. And that book is fascinating because it goes... If you just pick the book up cold and start reading it, you would think he's talking about the internet. He's actually talking about television. But what he is really stressing is the impact this technology is having on our attention span and how when you're listening to the radio, it's a very different form of communication than television because radio is auditory. It's a little more cerebral. But when you get into television, now we're bringing in the eye candy to hold people's attention. And that concept is even more so true when you look at the internet. But one of the things that he lamented in his book He said, if you go back to days of newspapers before we even had radio, what was in your local newspaper? Local news that impacted your life. New businesses starting, people dying, it's local news. And he said, even with the introduction of the telegraph, now we're getting news from Europe because there are telegraph cables stretched across the ocean. Now we're getting news from far away that does not impact our daily lives. And on top of that, because sending stories by telegraph is so time consuming, you're getting sound bites. So you're getting sensational sound bites that people are being distracted by rather than focusing on the local news that's actually important to their daily lives. So that's where my mind goes listening to that music. Mm-hmm. A disruption, and that disruption can be very distracting and take your mind off of the things that are more important because they're more sensational.
Yep, that's great. Well, John, thank you very much for playing the game show and for joining us here on the Rock Bottom Data Feed.
Been a pleasure. I've thoroughly enjoyed my visit with you today.
The 8-Bit Consultants. Advice in 256 characters or less, and four times better than those 2-Bit Consultants. Today's question. I'm being told that AI and data are about people, alignment, and collaboration. Ick. Sounds like I need to be a generalist.
Correct. Think again if you want to continue with just data things. AI will do the basic things you've enjoyed. Now, you need to be part of the business.
The 8-Bit Consultants. If you have a question in 256 characters or less, leave a comment or write us at rockbottom@counterthreadedproductions.com.
This broadcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. Counterthreaded is not responsible for any losses, damages, or liabilities that might arise from the use of this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast may not be those of the host or the management. This podcast is not intended to replace professional medical advice.
In this episode of the Rock Bottom Data Feed, John Padfield pushed us to think beyond what's technically possible and focus on what's ethically acceptable in a world of rapidly expanding data and AI. Surveillance, aggregation, and algorithmic systems can quietly reshape behavior, and society hasn't fully grappled with those consequences. From corporate responsibility to individual awareness, the message is clear. Just because we can collect and use data doesn't mean we should. Ultimately, this is less a technology problem and more a human one. It's about judgment, context, and accountability. It's one of the foundational themes of this show, anthropology. Be sure to visit dataversity.net and use discount code ROCK15 to get 15% off your first purchase. Until next time, this has been John Ladley and Mark Cooper for the Rock Bottom Data Feed. Thanks for listening, and remember, when you're here, you've reached rock bottom. You can find more information about the topics covered in this episode, more fuss about John Padfield, at our website, rockbottomdatafeed.com. The Rock Bottom Data Feed is a Counter-Threaded production, copyright 2026, all rights reserved.